Hello and welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast for the last week of September 2010. I'm reporter Elise Hugh, joined by CEO and Editor-in-Chief Evan Smith.
Hey, Elise.
Ben Philpott from the Tribune and KUT News.
Hello.
And Reeve Hamilton is subbing in for Ross today. Hi, Reeve.
Hello.
Today we're talking about the renewed campus gun debate, the new trend of not debating this fall, the editorial writers conference chastising Rick Perry last week, and the latest in CD-17, the Central Texas race featuring Congressman Chet Edwards and Bill Flores. Reeve, let's start with you, and we are taping on the day after a scare on the UT campus.
Right, so yesterday, Tuesday, UT, a 19-year-old student sort of ran around with an AK-47 firing randomly and then was ultimately chased into the library where he ended up killing himself. This is sort of brought up, I don't know how much it's brought up in the public, it's definitely brought it back up in the media, the debate about the concealed carry on school campuses. In Texas, there's a law against any guns on people carrying guns on campus. Last session, there was a bill that would have allowed people with concealed handgun licenses to carry on campus. It passed the Senate, and then because of the holdup in the House, it didn't get the sort of traction needed to get through the House.
This is the holdup where Democrats spent 3 days filibustering on the voter ID bill.
So it wasn't voted down so much as just not really considered.
Yeah, it didn't. It just, right. You know. But the people that were behind that bill have always planned on reintroducing that bill. Some of them, you know, it's a matter of whether or not they'll make it back for the next session.
Well, Dan Patrick was
even if they don't.
Dan Patrick was the lead actor on the Senate side, if I read the American Statesman correctly today, right? State senator from Houston.
He was a big actor. Jeff Wentworth actually carried the bill.
Wentworth carried it, not concealed. the bill, and but Patrick was a big supporter. Patrick was speaking out for it in the paper today, and on the House side,
it was Joe Driver.
Joe Driver,
who, when I called him, was not interested in giving a comment about it yesterday.
Somehow, Reeve managed to do a better job of reporting.
I guess so.
Well, he didn't want to comment on the incident, but he did say, you know, I have always planned on reintroducing this. I spoke with one of the big opponents of concealed carry, who is this UT graduate student who was at Virginia Tech when they had their massacre that killed 32 people. His girlfriend was among them. And John Wood says, you know, if this bill comes back, he will be there to fight it again. So we could just have a replay of last session.
But you understand, though, that an incident like this is only likely to make it more likely that this thing passes, because a precipitating event is often the thing that you need to persuade people on the fence that maybe we shouldn't.
But you can also look at what happened on Tuesday was actually that the system did a very good job of shutting down the crazed gunman. I mean, he started running on campus instantly. You had text messages go out to every student with a cell phone. The police were there almost instantly. They chased him in the library, and it ended without anyone
no one was hurt.
Getting hurt. I guess two people like twisted their ankle when they were running away. But he didn't hit anyone with his gun. So the system worked really well.
Right, but the people who are supporters of concealed carry on campus will say that we were lucky, we in the royal sense were lucky this time, and that the next time something like this happens, the greatest deterrent to a crazy person with a gun getting out on campus and shooting would be the knowledge that the person they're going to run into on the street may himself or herself be carrying.
Right, which assumes a sort of fear of death on the person running around with the gun.
Well, it assumes a rational mind, right, which we can assume is maybe not the case.
So interestingly, when we were covering this Joe Driver bill in 2009, I went back to the author of the concealed handgun law in Texas, Land Commissioner Jerry Patterson, who passed it in the early 90s, and asked him. He specifically exempted bars and schools and I believe churches. From the concealed handgun law, which is to say they're allowed everywhere else, but not those three places. And asked him what he thought in the wake of Virginia Tech and everything and the fact that Driver was bringing this bill. He is still against having guns on campuses because of the chaos that could ensue.
And of course, you know, the interesting thing about this is that this is really just reminded to people about the debate. A bunch of campus groups were already planning on hosting a sort of pro-gun rights.
In fact, they were planning on hosting at UT something yesterday.
Yes. Right, well, they did host it. They ended up hosting it across the street at Brave New Books instead. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this debate has sort of been around, and it's just going to stay around. This is just a reminder that it does matter.
I think there are a lot of logistics, though, that you know, that people are going to bring up when this argument comes up for or to be against this. You know, there was a time on Tuesday when people thought they were looking for a second gunman. And people were still locked down. Well, what if you're a concealed carry student and you start brandishing your gun walking around campus because you don't know if there's a second gunman? Well, guess who the police are going to stop and think is the second gunman? I mean, somebody brought this argument up to me yesterday. There are arguments to be made that, you know, yeah, in a situation like that, maybe now on the other side, how was Whitman pinned down for a half an hour? People went home and got their guns and came back to campus.
I would describe that as deer unconcealed carry.
Right.
Well, that was also just, you know, a different era. I mean, technology played a big role, I think, in the relative, lack
you know,
of
one of the groups,
damage
one
on
of
this
the groups,
incident.
One of the groups that was sponsoring the thing last night actually withdrew their support of the event. The event did end up going over to Brave New Books. The guy there, we had a reporter there last night from KUT. One of the things that he continued to talk about was that how well, you know, the title of his book, this is Mr. Lott, John Lott, I believe, is More Guns, Less Crime. And one of the points he brings up in the book and in his speech last night is that it's worked really well in Israel when they've made sure to try and arm as many Israelis as possible, that's kept down violence. That to me sounds a little racist.
Well, you also, but you often hear though that, you know, and speaking of Israel, you know, well, you know, El Al, the security forces, you know, the security mood and environment around El Al. That's why there were never any hijackings in Israel, is because they do this so much more militaristically. You know, they're just, you know, it's a question of whether you want to have that kind of environment or not in your life. I mean, the fact is, I know people say with regard to concealed carry on campus, you know. It's one thing to have a person with a concealed handgun potentially be a deterrent to Colton Tooley, who is the shooter. But, you know, somebody with a concealed handgun on campus gets a C on the paper. I mean,
well,
you know.
And we're talking about graduate students only. Right. Because they have to be at least 21.
Right.
You know, college is hard enough. Graduate school is even harder, more pressure.
And they have to be willing to go through the background check
and
the training.
And that's one great thing about
the
law in general.
Although I have to say that concealed carry, you may be a person may be for or against concealed carry in a general sense, but, you know, there's tension out in the world. There's stress out in the world. A guy with a gun on MLK off campus could, with a concealed handgun, do something as easily as somebody 5 feet away on campus could do it. I mean, there's almost not really much of a distinction, but there's no question that Virginia Tech type incidents and even this thing yesterday do embolden the people who believe that that this is a good idea. And, you know, I have no doubt that it's going to be back. It's one of the only things that they're going to push that's not going to cost anything this session. So it's probably increasing its chances of passage.
I did see a funny tweet yesterday where somebody responded to an argument that was going back and forth saying, sarcastically saying, yes, you're right. A trained police officer or a college student with a full backpack carrying a latte is bound to be able to respond to this better than a trained police officer.
Hmm. Well, let's leave the policy debate there.
Maybe we should get lattes off of campus.
Concealed latte. Concealed coffee. I like that.
Let's move into politics and your topic, Ben, about this not debating trend.
Well, we've gone, I think actually maybe it was even last week, we talked a bit about the idea of incumbents not being willing to debate, especially if they're up by several points. You know, we're getting more and more polling data every day. So they're up by double digits. They decide not to debate. We've also then had just kind of a trend nationally this time around where not debating has become more of a partisan issue. And you have had more, especially in Texas, but of course that's who's in power here in Texas. You had more conservatives, more Republicans not wanting to debate in some of the debates. I kind of witnessed last night the end game of that, which was a state school board District 5 debate with the Democratic candidate, the Libertarian candidate showing up, and the Republican incumbent, who was the chair of the school board. Ken Mercer,
but a significant actor on the school board.
Not showing up. And so the end game is you get a debate with a Libertarian and a Democrat without really addressing kind of the issues of what's going on the board currently, because all you can ask the people who aren't on the board is, what is your policy stance? It seemed like we were dancing around the issue, which is what is going on at the state board currently, because we had no current member of the state board in the room.
Well, what you end up having, and of course, speak
full disclosure.
Freely, full disclosure. Yeah. You know, I was the moderator of this forum. It was a forum more than a debate. Ken Mercer was invited, declined to attend. In the District 10 race, which also touches Austin, Marsha Farney, the Republican candidate, as well as the Libertarian candidate, declined to attend. The Democratic candidate, Judy Jennings, was there, but there couldn't be any discussion with her because, according to the rules of the forum, you had to have more than one candidate.
Why did the Libertarian decline?
Don't know why the Libertarian declined.
They didn't want that sort of exposure.
I guess not. Well, the Libertarian in District 5, Mark Lowy, was perfectly happy to have his time on camera, along with Rebecca Bell Medero, who was the Democrat. And, you know, the thing is, if there's no Republican in the debate, what it does is knock a lot of people who might have otherwise watched this thing off of watching it. And so, you know, it wasn't exactly American Idol from an entertainment standpoint, let's just say. But it was, you know, substantive to the degree that it could be, and there was a discussion of issues. But you're right that a lot of the oomph that you expect from debates is taken away. And, of course, the big kahuna in this whole discussion is the non-Rick Perry-Bill White debate. Now, the newspapers who proposed a debate on October 19th have announced they're going to have White and Kathy Glass and Deb Shafto debating with no Rick Perry. And Scott Braddock from KRLD in Dallas asked me today, did I think this was dangerous for White? I kind of think it is, actually. So White goes up on stage. First of all, he legitimizes the Libertarian and the Green Party candidates, who are peer candidates all of a sudden by being on stage with him. And White can only lose here. I mean, he gets the exposure, but let's say that one of the Libertarian or Green points made lands a punch on White. Now all of a sudden, White is putting himself at risk of either having people who are going to support him or emboldening the candidacies of these other people. He needs every anti-Rick Perry vote possible. Well, it's a difficult situation for him.
Politico wrote a thing about it might have been sort of, you know, just something to write, but they wrote a thing about Kathy Glass maybe peeling votes off of Rick Perry. If you legitimize the Libertarian candidate, does that sort of help you
maybe that's the
push
gamble
that
he's
along?
Going
well, but it also divides the anti-vote. Basically, 61% of the vote last election was anti-Rick Perry, but Rick Perry won because that vote was divided among three people. Now, that's not to say that if there had only been two candidates in the race, Chris Bell would have won. But there's no question that Bill White's math problem is partly every anti-Rick Perry vote has to be a Bill White vote, so any Kathy Glass or Deb Shafto vote is bad for him.
This was a big problem for Kay Bailey Hutchison in the primary, because I remember asking the Kay Bailey Hutchison campaign manager, is Deborah Medina peeling votes away from Rick Perry or peeling votes away from Kay Bailey Hutchison? Ultimately, the vote totals look like Kay Bailey Hutchison.
Well, and Hutchison made the mistake of sort of helping Medina in the debates, right? And instead of
She had sort of a you go girl moment, actually, right? But let's come back to the question of not debating as opposed to debating, and that is that the governor has calculated that the risk to him of debating, I'm just presuming this, is greater than not the risk of not debating. And you know, yes, he's making it an issue of Bill White's taxes, but the fact is, if you're the governor and you're up by X number of points, you would prefer to take a knee and run the clock out. Yep. Because the opportunity for you to say something that's is ultimately an exercise in snatching defeat from the jaws of victory, that's just greater if you put yourself on stage with White and you get provoked by something he says or by some, you know, jerky questioner. And so if you're the governor's campaign, you can kind of understand why their logic is don't debate.
And especially when you look at what numbers are jumping around on the polls. The numbers, Bill White's numbers are not jumping around. It's four Perry undecided. That's what's jumping around. So, yeah, you don't want to go on a debate and push people firmly towards the undecided or even Bill White area.
I will say also that, you know, as much as all of us in the press sagely stroke our chins and make the argument, you know, it's bad for democracy for there not to be a debate. It's terrible, you know.
It's crap.
A society that wasn't very sage, actually. A society like this one deserves the opportunity to compare and contrast. You know, that's a 78701 argument. You know, it's an inside baseball, inside the Capitol kind of thing. Out in, you know, Mejia, nobody's going, you know, I was going to vote for Rick Perry, but then he decided not to debate. and so I'm not going to vote for him. It's all of us. We're the ones who are talking about it, but I think there's not much risk to Perry out in the world.
I just thought that Rick Perry was waiting for Deb Shafto to get the invitation before he signed on. So I'm disappointed.
They've played those games before. Yeah, they have played those games before, too.
And you know, with Perry, it's a lot of who is holding the debates. I mean, he has drawn that line in there's us, him, Tea Party supporters, conservatives, and then there's the media. And pretty much any media is going to be the people that are sponsoring the debate. So he can very easily sit back and say, well, it's the media. Now, if the Tea Party were to sponsor a debate, I think he would have to say yes.
Let's stay on that topic of the media and jerky questioners, as Evan describes it, and talk a little about what happened at the editorial writers' conference.
Well, I was about to say, Ben just handed you a transition between segments. Thank you, Ben.
Well, yes.
Well, I actually wanted to talk about the governor and newspapers in a broad sense, and I'll start with the National Conference of Editorial Writers, which was in Dallas this week. Kevin Willey, the editorial page editor of the Dallas News, was the chair of this conference and the host, and she asked the governor to speak to this group, which he did do on Friday, but he did not take questions from the group. He simply delivered his remarks and then split. And this outraged the editorial writers, who felt like the governor owed them. I don't exactly know why they were so. I mean, I know that they were upset about it. I mean, I don't know if there was some agreement. I don't think there was an agreement in advance that they would take questions.
The Perry campaign says that they were well aware that he would not be taking questions.
And so, he did take questions from local, like a local press gaggle.
Well, he outside the great hall where the editorial writers gather, there were some local press people that he talked to on his way out.
So they were really miffed by this, and they wrote a very strongly
one of
worded...
That's one of the best letters of the campaign so far.
It was a very strongly worded letter complaining that the governor's operation had somehow let them down.
Utterly failed.
Obligated to answer questions. And then Mark Minor came back around and said, you know, yeah, the governor's time is well spent. I'm paraphrasing. The governor's time well spent answering questions from an editorial writer from Sheboygan, Wisconsin. Now, as it happens, I spoke to this group on Saturday night, and I was outraged at Mark on behalf of Wisconsinites. So I brought Texas Tribune hats and T-shirts for all the Wisconsinites at the conference, just to salve their wounds, you know, emotionally. But you know, it's clear that they were very upset by this, and it points to a larger issue, which is that the governor has decided to effectively flip off the newspapers, and this gets
all
to
but
the newspapers particularly, you know, refusing to appear before editorial boards in both the primary and in the general. And declining to do a lot of stuff that you would expect a governor running for re-election to do. Now, this goes back to, I believe, a poll that the Perry campaign took in Houston during the primary. We've talked about this before, where they asked in Houston specifically, if a candidate were endorsed by the Houston Chronicle, would that make you, Republican voter, more likely or less likely to support that candidate? And it was something like 24% said it would make it more likely, but 52% said it would be less likely. And this plays right into the antipathy that a lot of people on the right, and Tea Party guys, I guess, probably especially, have for the media. We're a bunch of liberal slime bags. Elitist, you know, latte drinking, pinky up in the air, you know, drinking kind of effete. How many more bad things?
You could just keep going.
Can I go?
Yeah, crap.
There's nothing you couldn't say.
We're talking
about
how much more time do we have on the podcast? So this basically plays into the meme out there, which is us versus them. And the them in this case is us.
And I think when you're talking about that poll, I think there's an assumption. Houston Chronicle, who would they endorse? Well, of course, they're a newspaper, so they would endorse a Democrat. So I am less likely to. I mean, I think that might be something that's playing out in their.
This is sort of the second half, Ben, of your point about the debates, which is, does not debating hurt the governor? I don't think it ultimately does. Does not, regardless of what we may think about that, does not dealing with editorial boards necessarily hurt the governor? Well, Kay Hutchison got every single newspaper's endorsement in the primary. How'd that work out for her?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so far already, the Chronicle, not a huge surprise, has endorsed White, but the expectation is that the big papers and probably almost all of the small papers will end up endorsing White, if only because White's appearing before the editorial boards, and they're going to be hard pressed to endorse Perry.
He's sitting down with the Statesman editorial board as we speak now.
He, Bill White.
Yeah.
So the question is, does that hurt the governor? And I think the answer, like the debate question, is probably not. And we're witnessing the transformation of the relationship between the newspapers and elected officials.
Well, part of the argument that they put forward, we're not talking to editorial writers, is that, you know, that they're really just talking to a private group of people when their time is better spent talking to the public, which you would seem logically would play out to you should debate if your goal is to talk directly to the public.
Right, but what they say is we're talking to the people directly. We don't need to do a debate. We don't need to have Wayne Slater ask us questions on camera to reach the people.
So no unedited moments, I guess.
No raw.
Yeah.
Again, you know, we find it irritating and anti-democratic with Esmaldi and all that. They go, look, it doesn't hurt us not to debate. It doesn't hurt us not to talk to editorial boards. We'd rather not do it. We have our reasons. You can disagree with them, but until they start hurting our chances to get reelected, we're going to keep at it.
Sure.
And, you know, I don't know that other governors are in the same frame of mind, but this governor definitely is where he is, and he's unmoved.
Well, with our last 2 minutes, my topic is...
I'm sorry.
Oh, no problem. It wasn't your fault.
You're losing some time here.
Yeah. My topic is just Congressman Chet Edwards and businessman Bill Flores challenging him in CD17. That's basically it. That's
only
all I have to say about
2 minutes.
No. No, well, what I wanted to say is that, you know, I've always thought that Chet Edwards was Teflon guy. You know, as a reporter in Waco, I covered Arlene Wolgamuth challenging him, and she was really supposed to beat him in 2004. And he has amazingly survived, and not just her challenge, but other challenges before and after that. So he's amazingly survived year after year, but Bill Flores is now touting a poll showing him up on Edwards by 19 points.
Right, although it's very important to point out that we were offered the results of that poll to publish in the Tribune, and we did not publish them because we wanted to see the crosstabs, and they would not give us the crosstabs.
Okay.
And
we
we did not publish them. So, I mean, I think that we certainly can talk about that poll, but I want to say we have no knowledge of that poll's credibility, because until they show you the crosstabs, you have no idea who or what was polled.
Absolutely, and you know how I feel about polls in general.
I know you don't like polls anyway.
So, what is interesting is that Waco, that television market, Waco Temple Bryan, is a lot more affordable instead of to buy television. So they are in this massive ad war. You know, we have a Waco television partner, and in between the news, almost every other commercial seems to be either Chet Edwards or Bill Flores. So it is an exciting race to watch, and this could be the year, I guess, that Chet Edwards finally gets toppled. Do y'all think so?
Well, even Teflon degrades eventually, right?
Does it?
Yeah. Thanks for bringing the room down, Reeve. I have all these pots at home. I'm now.
Reeve, you're not supposed to use metal cookware. Come on, don't use forks on it.
Yes, he could lose, but there's not a guarantee that even in a year like this he will lose, because there may be no better example in the country of a congressman about whom it can be said the district says, "I hate everybody in Congress, and I'm this." But I like my guy. Mm-hmm. Edwards has been the guy that his district, which we say repeatedly, is the most Republican congressional district held by a Democrat in the country. They have liked this guy.
Right.
Flores is a good candidate. Edwards is a good candidate. And, you know, Edwards could be the one to hold off the tsunami.
Have they had a debate?
Oh, good question. I don't think so. I remember the Flores-Kernock debate, which was badly produced.
And there's a case where I think Edwards, it's interesting, I wonder if Edwards is doing... In his case, what Perry is doing. So the problem of not debating is not a Republican problem. I think it's important to say that there are a lot of Democrats. I remember last time Lloyd Doggett wouldn't debate his opponent in CD25 in 2008. Right. And I think it's outrageous when anybody does that. Edwards might have more to lose, honestly, in a debate than Flores.
You know, I wonder, because a lot of the noise being made in this election is the noise from Tea Party members, people upset with incumbents in general. And, you know, when there's a lot of noise being made, there's not necessarily a lot of correct information being thrown around at really loud rallies, no matter which side is throwing the rally. Because it's a rally. You just throw out stuff and see who screams. So I wonder if maybe a debate on his side would help in maybe trying to cut through.
It's less ideological.
It's not just anti-incumbent, it's also sort of no compromise. And to agree to a debate, you're sort of allowing some room for your...
I will say this. Edwards is not taking a knee.
No.
Right. Edwards is absolutely fighting with everything he has to hold on to the seat. And so, again... It
brings us to the end of our Teflon podcast. And thanks to our audio engineer, Todd Wiseman. On behalf of Evan, Ben, and Reeve, I'm Elise. Thanks for listening.